Okay, so this winter and spring, we are in the Old Testament book of Judges. So Judges, in terms of history, it takes place between the Exodus of Egypt and the monarchy in ancient Israel. Have you guys ever been in a conversation with someone and they're telling you a story, and the story that they're telling, maybe of an experience they just had or a first date, something like that, and the story just gets worse and worse as the story goes, and you just get to a place, as you, the listener, you just kind of put your hands up and you say, stop, I can't take this anymore, okay? So Judges chapter 8 is like that. In fact, the entire book of Judges, as we progress, it gets a lot worse and a lot darker as we get into it. In Judges 8, we see the ripple effects of the fall, when our first parents rebelled and wandered away from God. For the last 2 weeks, we've been looking at this one specific guy named Gideon. And he is one of the judges that the Lord raised up to rescue the people of God from their oppressors. And Gideon has a very compelling story arc. When we meet him, he's somewhat reluctant to lead. And so in Judges chapter 6, he asks God for a series of signs to confirm that he's actually being called to be a judge, to deliver these people from their oppressors, in their case, the Midianites. In Judges 7, we see Gideon fully step into that role as a judge, placing his faith in the Lord and not in the numbers. So last week we talked about this battle that he went into with 300 of his guys and no weapons. At the end of Gideon's story, we see a harsher version of him. We see a guy who's full of he's vengeful and violent. And as the book of Judges plays out, we begin to see like these deeper flaws in these judges. And so Gideon's story, it's one of those that like begins well, but ends badly. So let's keep chipping away at his story. So I've asked Jamie Hawkins to read this passage. So she's coming up, let's stand together. And Jamie's just gonna read a portion of Judges chapter 8.
And Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over, he and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing. So he said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. And the officials of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your army? And Gideon said, well then, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. And from there he went to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. And he said to the men of Penuel, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower.
The word of the Lord. You may have a seat. Thanks, Jamie. Okay. So Gideon and his 300 men, these guys are exhausted from this battle that they were just in. And they're pursuing two prominent Midianite leaders. Those guys are named Zeba and Zalmunna. And Gideon and his guys, they've just crossed over the Jordan River into a place called Succoth. And he asked the people there to give his men some bread. But the people in that city refuse. And you can hear like the sarcasm in their voice. They say this to Gideon, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your army? In other words, they're basically saying like, why should we give you guys anything. You haven't caught the bad guys yet. A similar response comes from a different town, I think it's pronounced Penuel. No one knows how to pronounce these words in Judges, by the way. We're just doing the best we can. So they say basically the same thing. We're not going to help you guys. And so that doesn't sit too well with Gideon. And he says to them in verse 7, well then. Now you can already tell, like when someone says, like, well then, you're like, what's he going to say now? He says this, well then, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. And then he also says to the people in Penuel in verse 9, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. Now, obviously, there's a contradiction in language there, right? Like, I'm going to come in peace, and I'm going to break stuff. And you can hear this, like, sense of entitlement in Gideon. One of the commentators that I read this week writes this. Gideon feels that he ought to receive admiration and honor for what he has done. His anger at the people of Succoth and Penuel shows that he expects to be given glory for his achievements, which he is forgetting were in fact God's. When Succoth and Penuel fail to trust that Gideon will triumph over Midian, he does not say to them, yes, I know it's hard to believe we can beat them, but God in his grace is giving us to win the battle, so don't trust my strength, but do trust in his. Instead, he says, you dare to doubt me? I'll show you my power when I get back, and you'll learn to have respect for me. And so Gideon pursues, captures these two dudes, the Midianite guys, Zeba and Zalmunna. He then returns to these towns that rejected, like didn't give his army bread, Succoth and Penuel, and he does exactly what he told them he would do. And so the narrator tells us in verses 13 through 17, then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres, and he captured a young man of Succoth and questioned him, and he wrote down for him the officials and elders of Succoth, 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted? And he took the elders of the city, he took thorns of the wilderness and briars with them, taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And then he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. That's what I mean when this story gets worse and worse and darker and darker. Gideon questions these two guys that they captured, Zeba and Zalmunna, about a group of men that they had killed at a place called Tabor. And as it turns out, the men that those guys killed were Gideon's brothers. How do you think this is going to go? So Gideon tells his oldest son, his name is Jether, to kill those guys, like right then and there. And the text tells us that he couldn't do it because he was afraid. And you can almost kind of sense, like, Gideon just, like, taking, like, just out of, you know, out of fear, like, just frustration, like, just taking the sword from his son, and then he does it himself. Like, he kills these two guys. At this point, I'm not sure we're dealing with, like, God delivering his people from their oppressors. It feels like the way the text is reading, it feels like we're dealing with someone who's, like, settling scores. Like a personal vengeance, a personal vendetta. Gideon's behavior is going to really set the tone for the rest of Gideon's time as judge. And so sadly, we're kind of seeing this guy self-destruct. His story begins well and ends badly. So let's stop here just for a moment. Like in Gideon, we see someone who experiences success in these battles, And that success turns him into this violent, angry, entitled guy. Like, his heart isn't softened by the fact that the Lord was the actual one who was winning these battles. Rather, his heart is hardened. And success has been the worst thing for him. He becomes addicted to respect and honor that success brought him. And we see this in how he treats others. So another commentator writes this: there is a terrible spiritual danger involved in the receiving of any blessing. Success can easily cause us to forget God's grace because our hearts are desperate to believe that we can save ourselves. You guys, this is not an original story. Like, over and over, we see that the human heart cannot handle like an overabundance of success and power. Sometimes the worst thing that can happen to a person, depending on that person, is success and power. There's a danger to it. One of my friends and elder in a church that we pastored in Tryon, church was called Grace Foothills. This guy's name was Bob Mackey, and we just called him Mackey. And Mackey would often say things like this. He would say, Christians typically don't do well with power. A few years ago, there was a podcast that told the story of the rise and fall of a prominent pastor and church. And in one part of the podcast, this pastor travels to London to speak at a conference. And in London, he's approached by a group of, like, fanboys who ask for his autograph. They ask for, like, to get pictures with him and stuff like that. And this guy, this pastor, is with some of his colleagues and staff. And they get into a taxi to go somewhere. And the pastor says to his colleagues, he goes, "I don't know if you've noticed or not, but I'm kind of a big deal." And then this one of his colleagues laughed, thinking he was quoting Anchorman, because Will Ferrell says the same thing about himself in that film, Anchorman. And then this guy realizes that the pastor was serious, and then this guy thought to himself, "Man, we're in trouble." And then a few years later, this guy, this pastor, and his church, like, the church just basically dissolved in a matter of months. And we're talking thousands of people in a big city in the Pacific Northwest. It dissolved because this guy, this pastor, had created this very toxic culture, and he was a bully. Caitlin Beatty, in her book, Celebrities for Jesus, she writes this: if you have belonged to a community where power was stewarded poorly, you have seen the devastating effects. Perhaps you carry the devastation within you. When power becomes an idol, promising those with power that they can be like God apart from God, those in power seek not to bless, but to dominate. They take what is not theirs, exploit, crush, defeat, gaslight, ridicule, and silence. In their presence, others feel disempowered. And this is why power has such a bad rap, because doesn't this account of power just seem like the oldest story in the book? This is the type of power Jesus warned against in Matthew 20 when he said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them." The operative word here is "over." Jesus is describing a power that seeks to rule over others rather than for others. Another translation of this verse says, "Their great ones are tyrants over them." Have you ever worked for a tyrant? They are both unrestrained and frankly scary. You feel disempowered rather than empowered because of the way they lead. And that's the point. They want you to quake, if only a bit, at their power over you. This is not the power that Jesus' disciples are to seek. "Not so with you," Jesus says. If we want to be at the top, Jesus says, go lower. It's the opposite of what our idol-making hearts want. And as we see the story of Gideon, he is beginning to fall into that tyrant category. And you guys, all this is a cautionary tale for us. It's tempting to hear these stories and think that we're immune to such behavior or heart posture. And perhaps it's more healthy to use these kind of stories to ask ourselves the hard questions. Like, where does my self-importance or my pride lurk? Like, how do I use or misuse power? Back in Judges 7, when Gideon was like aware of his weaknesses, he was aware of his need and dependence on the Lord, that brought him to a place of worship in the Lord. Like, that version of Gideon is long gone. Here in Judges 8, we see Gideon worshiping not God, but his own respect, his own honor, his own success. You guys, sometimes the thing that we need most is to experience failure. And I know that sounds kind of unhinged, but when we fail, the sweetness of the gospel gets sweeter. When we fail, we're reminded that we are not in control, that we need God's transformative grace, and we need the posture of humility. So let me ask you all, not to answer out loud, but just like when you wake up and you begin your day, your week, do you kind of wake up thinking, man, I'm really looking forward to like failing today in whatever your thing is, right? Like if you're a student, that's probably, I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want to fail your exams, right? But do you understand what I'm saying? Like, there is a sweetness when we experience failure. Gideon does have a moment of clarity, but as soon as it comes, it's gone. And so the narrator tells us this in verses 22 and 23. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian." And Gideon said to them, and you can just kind of feel the tone in what he says. He just says, look, man, like, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. And he shows, like, some wisdom here, some discernment by rejecting their request to, like, put him in this place of king or power. And he's really saying to them, you don't need a king to obey, you need to obey the king that you already have. And in this brief moment of clarity, Gideon immediately contradicts what he said. Because right after he says that, he begins to behave like a king. So he has 70 sons with several different wives. He has one son from a concubine. He names that son Abimelech. And Abimelech's name means my father is king. Gideon then takes the gold, like basically tells the people, like, hey, any gold that you've gotten from the enemy, bring it here. So they bring to him all this gold, and then he melts it down into what's called an ephod. And an ephod is some sort of, like, it's what the high priest would wear in the tabernacle. So this is, again, just in terms of our history here, the temple, Solomon's temple, doesn't exist yet. The tabernacle was this movable tent that God told Moses to basically build, and that's where it was the center of Israelite worship. And so the high priest in that tabernacle would wear like a piece of jewelry called the ephod. And so Gideon is saying, basically, bring me the gold, let's make one of those. And then he set that ephod up in his town. And this is what the narrator tells us what happens. And all Israel whored after it. And it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. Okay, so how do we make sense of Gideon's trajectory? Another commentator writes this. Quite simply, Gideon knew something intellectually which had not been really gripped his heart. He had a mental grasp of the doctrine of God's grace and rule, and he could give the right answer in some situations, but his heart had not really understood how this truth worked itself out in all of life. There was a huge and growing gap between what he believed about God in his head and the motives of his heart and actions of his hands. And so this is what Paul David Tripp and Tim Lane in their book, You Can Change, or it's called How People Change. This is what they call the gospel gap. In other words, the gospel gap is this chasm between like our intellectual theology and our practical theology. It's a gap between the head and the heart. And in Gideon, we see that gap. Like one minute he's saying the Lord will rule over you, and the next minute he's saying, actually, I'm going to rule over you, and I'm going to do it with cruelty. So as we come to passages like this, you guys, like the question really is, like, how are we like these characters? Like, how are we like Gideon? What does the gospel gap look like in our lives? And we do this in a million different ways. And so let me share with you one of mine. So over the years, I've shared with you guys that I have like a superpower, like Superman. I have super sarcasm. And I discovered this, as most people do, in middle school. So my sarcasm got me into all kinds of trouble, and it got me out of all kinds of trouble, too. And it works well when you're young, but sarcasm doesn't quite translate so well when you become an adult and, like, get an actual job, right? And it certainly doesn't translate well when you are working in the local church. Like, you know what I mean? Like, sarcasm, like, there's a place for it, but when you're a pastor and you have a staff and you have elders and deacons and small group leaders and volunteers and then just you all, right? Sarcasm is not super helpful, depending on the thing, right? So in one of my previous jobs as a pastor, this is about 20 years ago, I had an exit interview as I was leaving this position. And my supervisor, who was also my pastor and friend, this is what he said to me. And he said this out of a place of like love for me, right? So sometimes the people that you love, you've got to say hard things to. And this is what he said. He said, Scott, you have a facial expression that makes people feel stupid. And that's just like, that'll get your attention. And as you think about it, you're like, I can't see my face, right? Like, I'm blind to that. We all have those blind spots in us. And it just broke my heart because I'm like, the Lord has called me to be a pastor and I make people feel stupid. I have a condescending look. And so he said to me, he said, hey man, like, it might be a good idea for you to like just like take a break from full-time ministry and just sit in God's grace for you. Sit in God's love and commitment for you. Because he said, this is what he said too. He said, we cannot give grace to people if we are not receiving it ourselves. And so I took his suggestion. I took 2 years off from like full-time ministry. And this is the season I've told you stories about working in Memphis in this logistics facility for about 2 years. And during that time, I needed that time. I needed that space to be out of the church, be out of any kind of ministry, and for God to work on me and God to work in my heart. And he did. So, if I'm ever hanging out with you guys and I give you a look, you need to tell me. You need to say, hey, remember that story you told us about your pastor who said you have a look, a facial expression that makes people feel stupid? You're doing it to me right now, right? I need to know that because we all, you know, we all revert. We all fall back into old patterns. Before we end our time looking at Gideon's story, I do want to point out that he is mentioned as this example of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. So Hebrews 11 is this very famous passage that just lists, it starts from Abraham, and it just basically lists like all these cool people from the Old Testament, and basically is pointing to like, hey, these people exhibited faith, and let's celebrate that, right? These flawed people, let's celebrate their faith, and Gideon's one of them. And so this is what the author of Hebrews says. He says, and what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. And so immediately after the author of Hebrews says that, the author also says this in Hebrews 12, like the very next chapter. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. It's as if the author of Hebrews is saying, be careful not to idolize your leaders. Be careful of your own pride and self-salvation. Be self-aware of the gospel gap within you. Following Jesus is like running a very long race. Run with endurance and fix your eyes on him and who he is and what he's done for you. He went to the cross with a sense of dread and joy, knowing that the end result of the cross and the resurrection would be the restoration of man back to God, like a return to Eden. You guys, Jesus not only started well, he ended well. And he's the antithesis of Gideon's story and how his story ends. Jesus started well, ended well for you, for me. And Judges 8, it's like Judges 8 is crying out for a better judge, a better ruler, a better king. And in the gospel, we get one. And you guys, that's good news. So obviously, we're in an election year. And wow, isn't that fun? And so this year, everybody on both sides, they are vying for your vote, right? And the language that's used is, it feels apocalyptic, right? They're like, this is the most important election of our lifetime, right? And fear is used. That kind of mindset is used. And I'm not, like, man, there's so much to say here that I want to say. When we are in an election year, these folks who are trying to get our votes, there's only one who can really save us, right? And so we are citizens of this country, but don't forget that we're also citizens of heaven. Like, we're just passing through this place. And so we are to be called to be good citizens, to love our neighbors, vote your conscience, that kind of stuff. But it's very dangerous, just like those guys who asked for that pastor's autograph, right? And that pastor said, in case you haven't noticed, I'm kind of a big deal, right? Like, it's very dangerous for the human heart to get connected and put someone that's also made in God's image on that kind of pedestal in place. So Jesus is the king. He's what our hearts are longing for. And so Yeah, I think that's about all I'll say about that. Let's pray together. Lord, we thank you for Gideon's story. It's hard. And so often we see in him, like we see our story, our trajectory. Like there's places in Gideon's story that are really cool, that he exhibited faith in you. And then at the end of his story, he's this like very violent guy. And this gap happened in him, in his heart. And we're just like him. And so, Lord, I pray for my friends that you would be with us this week. You would help us to be self-aware in how we treat others. And, Lord, that we would be people who are soft towards God, soft towards other people, that we have tenderness about us, a kindness about us. And when we're with people, they don't feel like they're, you know, the way I made people feel 20 years ago. That the gospel of grace would really work in our hearts. And that Jesus would come out in how we love our neighbor. So we pray all these things in his name. Amen.